Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. I am excited to have this conversation with you guys, to listen and seriously grab paper, some pens, coffee, whatever you need, sit back and get ready to absorb this information, coming together and collaborating, cooperating, compromising to come and find a beautiful consensus to better support the children that we serve. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am my mom and special educator. I have sat at both sides of that IEP table as a parent and a professional. And over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick-butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a download, a follow, a like, or a share. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome, Katie and Lori. I am looking forward to talking with you today about out-of-the-box school accommodations and other lesser-known special education IEP tips, specifically supporting students with ADHD. So welcome and thank you.
We're so excited to be here.
I love
this. Thank you for having us.
Yes. Let's go ahead and just introduce yourselves to folks that are listening so they have a little bit of background on who you are and how you help strategize in the world of special education.
Yeah, so I'm Lori Long. I'm a child psychologist and I have a private practice in Scottsdale, Arizona. And in my private practice, I specialize in evaluating students for ADHD and autism and learning disorders. I also specialize in independent educational evaluations through my practice, which I'm sure we'll kind of talk a little bit about today. But anytime a child is struggling at school, I can kind of go in and provide recommendations and kind of an outside objective kind of look at how a student is doing in educational planning for that student. But we are here today because I also have the Childhood Collective with Katie and Mallory. And we founded that a couple years ago because we really saw parents of kids with ADHD kind of struggling to find science-backed resources and strategies. And we put together courses to really help parents have easy, simple strategies to implement at home to help, you know, develop happy and independent kids with ADHD, both at home and at school. So that's kind of what we do through the Childhood Collective.
Yes. And I'm Katie Severson. I'm a speech language pathologist. And I actually got connected to the ADHD world because I grew up in a family with a lot of ADHD and really just have a huge passion with executive functioning and supporting kids and adults with challenges with executive functioning. And so I worked in private practice for about 11 years as a speech pathologist. And it seemed like in private practice, you see whoever walks through the door, but I just would always gravitate towards those families with ADHD and kids who really consistently struggled with executive functioning. And the last probably about 6 years, I transitioned into private practice as well and with a psychology office. And so I was actually working with Lori and Mallory at one point, and I would come in as a speech language pathologist and help with these assessments, right? So the psychology team is looking at diagnostics, those kinds of things, but there's a lot of areas that kids with ADHD can have difficulties with: language, executive functioning, and these are all part of the speech language pathology scope of practice. And so I got really into those types of evaluations and treatment. And that's actually one of the ways that we all connected back in the day. And so none of us work at that practice anymore, but it's just such a fun memory. And I think that that's where, as a team, we kind of all bring different areas of expertise. So Lori with a very strong background in testing and school-based supports, I bring the executive functioning piece and kind of the nuts and bolts of like parent behavior training and, you know, therapy. And then Mallory has a ton of experience. She's not here with us today, but she's another child psychologist who has a lot of experience with parent training, and she's trained in PCIT, that model, and that kind of thing. So together, we've created online courses to support families at home and at school. And everything we provide is completely geared towards ADHD.
Yeah. And just to elaborate, Mallory and I are both school psych, like our background and training is in school psychology. So all of our training was really on educational psychology and how to support kids in the school setting.
It's so fantastic that you offer this service. And as you said a couple of words, I was like, yes, yes, yes. In terms of like easy, simple, team approach.
Yes.
It should be that across the board all the time. And I always say that like, it just should not be this hard for parents that are just trying to navigate a world where the language, especially in a school system, a public school system, the world of special ed is just a whole different language. And
yes,
and I always say that, you know, if it's your baby, it's this fear and love, and then you're trying to learn a new language and navigate things, and you don't always know what you don't know. So I love that the three of you make things easy and simple and take that team approach.
Yes. Yeah. The language of the school setting is so confusing to parents. And so many times, even after I meet with a family and kind of review some of that with them, they will go to a meeting and they're like, they kept saying these terms and like, I don't know what this means. And it's just, it's very confusing and it's hard to understand the laws, and parents need this information to be able to navigate supporting their kids at school.
So let's take a look at kind of where this all starts. So if I have a student, my child has ADHD, is the school responsible for identifying and referring kids with ADHD to special education? Is the parent, what does that mean and how do they do that?
That is a great question and a loaded question.
I know, I love it. I feel like we're both like, okay, let me roll up my sleeves. Let's dive in.
Get in there. Let's do it.
You know, the schools are responsible for identifying kids with ADHD and supporting them. Yes, absolutely. However, the schools do not typically provide a medical diagnosis of ADHD. So that's why it's very confusing for families. But just because they might not necessarily provide that medical diagnosis, school psychologists have a lot of training in ADHD. It's the most common referral that comes up in the school setting and in private practice among kids. So they're very familiar and have training with the ADHD. They can do evaluations to identify if that's impacting them in the school setting. However, you might go to one school and a school psychologist might say, I can't evaluate this or provide supports until you get a medical diagnosis. And another school psychologist might evaluate and say, no, we suspect that they have ADHD, or they might even diagnose it. And they'd provide an individual education plan or a 504 plan to support students. So honestly, you know, I see a variety of ways that schools identify kids, and it's not consistent. And that's why, again, it's a very frustrating and challenging process to navigate for parents.
Why is that? Why is there not a consistent form of that in terms of, if you have a school psychologist, wouldn't the training be similar that they could then do that? What is the difference that you have seen?
The training is similar, but the process and the goal of a school-based evaluation versus a medical evaluation is different. So the goal of a school-based evaluation is to evaluate a student to identify, are they meeting the criteria for these kind of administrative categories that we've developed in the law to say a child needs help or services at school? And that's really the goal of their evaluation. Does a child need supports, and do they meet the criteria, these administrative criteria? The administrative criteria sometimes align with a medical diagnosis, but they sometimes don't. So for instance, specific learning disability does align with a medical diagnosis of a specific learning disorder. They're fairly similar and they have similar names. But at school, when we look at eligibility for special education for ADHD, a lot of times it's this category of other health impairment, which is very odd and confusing to parents. So there is no ADHD category at school, which makes it very challenging, again, for the schools. Their goal is to look at, do they meet the criteria for this category? Their goal is not to give you a medical diagnosis. So I guess part of it is what their purpose is in the school setting. And it's different than providing a medical diagnosis.
And that being said, we believe that if a child is given a diagnosis of ADHD, a medical diagnosis of ADHD, a piece of that diagnosis is that this affects them across all areas, right? In multiple settings. And so when we look at, is it having an educational impact? That's where we start to get into kind of, I wouldn't necessarily call it a gray area, but it seems like there's room for debate. And that becomes like, okay, this child, if they do have a medical diagnosis of ADHD, they're going to have difficulty with executive functioning across the board. And so even if their grades are doing fine, and again, we can kind of like parse that out, like, well, are A's and B's fine? What about C's? But really that's not the only criteria that we want schools to be looking at. And so it's kind of like a difference when Lori's describing, this is what the system is currently set up to do. And then there's kind of like our ideal world where we would say like, yes, kids with ADHD do need support in the academic and in the school setting for all sorts of things, including and mostly linked to executive functioning.
And that OHI is a big category, right? It's a huge umbrella that not everybody is really clear on that, you know, that may be sitting at the table in terms of a parent or so forth. And, you know, you could have somebody with ADHD under OHI and you could have somebody with, you know,
cancer, or asthma, exactly. Or yeah.
Yes. There's just so many in that umbrella. And to think about that, and you're right in terms of the educational impact, because many parents will say, oh, well, their grades are fine. But what does fine look like? And where is that impact, right? Are you impact, you know, oh, I'm always like bell to bell, bus to bus, where, you know, transitions, recess, lunchroom, where are these executive function? Where is the attention? Where is the impact that, yes, okay, their grades are fine, but how much energy and effort and time is going into fine?
Yeah.
Well, that, and I think a lot of kids will look fine, and I put that in quotes, at school, and then they come home and it's like, as parents, we see the complete meltdown, right? Like they have expended every ounce of energy and then some while holding it together all day at school. And if we're able to give kids better supports than at school, then they don't come home so exhausted and drained.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So if we could just for a second, and then we're going to kind of come back to what that support would look like, can we transition to a school-based evaluation versus like a private evaluation? What is the difference there? Because parents are always asking, you know, oh, should I go through the school to have my child evaluated? Should I pay outside money to have my child evaluated? What is the difference?
That's such a great question. And there isn't like a great straightforward answer. We usually recommend if your child is really struggling in the school setting, and that's like the predominant challenge that you're facing right now, I would say move forward with that school-based evaluation. If you're seeing symptoms related to ADHD and you have concerns, I'd say do both. Because again, many schools want to see that medical diagnosis to be able to provide the supports, 504 planner and IEP at school. So I would say if you can do both, try and do both, but maybe start with the school if that's the main issue. If you're finding that most of your challenges are related to homework and things at home, and you need those supports right away as a parent, maybe go the medical evaluation first to get some of those resources in place if school isn't the main issue. So I think that's kind of a simple way of putting it, but I would say if there's a concern about ADHD, you really kind of, we would recommend that you do both.
Can you tell us some of the importance of students being evaluated either with medication or without medication?
Yeah, that's another great question. When you're talking about, this is my personal opinion and other psychologists might have different opinions, but what I tell parents when they come into testing with me is if you're questioning if your child has ADHD, so this is their, you know, their first kind of full evaluation. So many of our kids with ADHD have gone to see a pediatrician already, right? And a pediatrician can diagnose ADHD. But what we find is that many kids with ADHD have other co-occurring diagnoses. In fact, 80% of kids with ADHD have other diagnoses, including anxiety or depression or learning disorders like dyslexia or autism. And so that's why they're coming for a more comprehensive assessment. So some kids that I might see in private practice have already seen the pediatrician who's maybe given kind of a brief evaluation and diagnosis and said, try the medication, right? And that's a lot of times the only kind of recommendation parents are getting is here's the medication. So maybe they've started a trial of that. If the parents are kind of like, I'm not sure if it's ADHD or if it's autism or if it's a learning disorder that's the main issue why they're having trouble focusing, I always tell parents, I want to see them without medication. Like if the question is, do they have ADHD? And that's the main question a parent comes to me asking, I don't want them on medication. If we're looking at initial school supports and they have not had an evaluation at school, I wouldn't recommend giving your child medication on the days that they're being evaluated at the school. Okay. And that's not just my recommendation. There's a letter through the Office of Civil Rights. It's called the Dear Colleague Letter. And so basically, if you're a parent of a child with ADHD and you're listening, you're saying, yeah, it's been really hard for me to get supports at school. You are not alone because the Office of Civil Rights had thousands of complaints over a 5-year period. To the point where they wrote this letter to schools saying, there are so many things that we're seeing you're doing wrong and you are violating kids' rights, and we're going to list out guidelines for you. So this letter is really, really important for parents to know because it lists out kind of what should be done in the schools for kids with ADHD. And one of the things that they recommend in that letter is not evaluating kids on medication, because sometimes kids will be on medication and you're like, they're doing great, but that's not always going to be the case. And the medication might not always be working, and that's not good for the initial evaluation of what they need. So that was a recommendation too within that letter.
When we're looking at more like speech and language or those kinds of things, Lori, like if you're looking at testing a child's academic performance and let's say they've been on medication for a few years, then you typically would recommend that they do have whatever medication they normally have, similar to like you would want them to wear their glasses or those kinds of things.
So I think the other situation that I might come across in private practice, like what Katie is saying, is you have an established diagnosis of ADHD. The school has recognized it. You have recognized it. You're not questioning if they have ADHD. It's apparent. Your question is, does my child have dyslexia or a reading challenge or a math challenge? And I want to look at that. Then I would say, have them take their medication, because then I'm going to get a better assessment of like their actual skills and not attention challenges that go along with that.
And I do think it's important for parents that are listening, if you're going through the process right now of an evaluation, to talk to your evaluator, because they might say something different. And regardless of how you decide, it makes sense for them to put that in the report. So whenever I would test kids with ADHD and parents would say, oh, they're not on their meds today, or they are, I would write that in the report just to document it. And similarly to like, if they said, oh, he didn't sleep last night at all, I would document that in my background too, just because that is a mitigating factor. And we want to know a better picture of what was this child like, what did they look like when they came in that day. So I think it's sort of like, those are great recommendations. And then just talk to your evaluator, because again, everyone might have different thoughts.
It can be so overwhelming, right? As you're talking, and we're talking about, you know, it's not straightforward, right? So it's never just ADHD. You know, you talked about co-occurring medical barriers or other diagnoses that go hand in hand. Where would a parent start? Like, where do you even start when you're feeling overwhelmed and you see your kiddo struggling and melting down or any of these things? Like, where would a parent start in terms of deciding, you know, who do I speak to first, and how do I prioritize?
Well, I was going to say, if you're thinking of school, like that the child is struggling at school, we typically start with talking to the teacher. And if you know that your child is maybe has difficulties with attention, let's say they don't even have a diagnosis, but you know, oh man, pre-K was rough. My child was always moving around on circle time rug, and it's going to be difficult. We always recommend just starting to establish rapport with the teacher right off the bat. So we don't want to wait until things aren't going well, but checking in, you know, regularly. And it could be as simple as just, hey, how's your week going? I wanted to check in on my son and see, you know, how things are going. He was so excited to tell me about their project that they did last week, you know, and keeping that rapport, building that rapport and keeping it going. And then starting with a conversation with the teacher. And depending on how that goes, typically we would then request a school meeting. But I don't know if I'm answering your exact question. So were you thinking like, where would a parent start if things aren't going well at school?
I think just in general, I mean, I think if you're talking about co-occurring, if you're talking about the co-occurrence of say ADHD and anxiety or a learning disability, and as a parent, you see your baby struggling, you don't really know how to suss out what could be what.
Yeah.
How do you know, or what, is there any one thing and maybe not that you could tell a parent to prioritize in terms of, if I'm going for an evaluation, how do you kind of start that conversation?
Yeah, I think if you're kind of suspecting that it's ADHD, talking with your pediatrician and kind of getting an appointment with them is always a good place to start. Your pediatrician should know your child pretty well. Like, they've followed them for a long time and you usually have a good relationship with them. And they can a lot of times really support you and maybe help figure that out. I think parents do need to know. I see many kids who go to a pediatrician and maybe like did an evaluation and the teachers, for instance, wrote on that evaluation that there were significant concerns about reading, but nothing, there was no follow-up with that, right? So pediatricians aren't always educated about dyslexia or who tests for that. They have to know a lot about a lot of different areas. So like, they're not going to necessarily know that, but they can refer you to some, you know, a psychologist that specializes in that. And they usually have good referrals in those areas to say, I can maybe help you if it's just ADHD and that sort of the concern. But if you're also having, you're seeing your child worrying excessively, or you're seeing other emotional concerns, or you're seeing academic challenges, you might want to see a specialist to kind of parse those things out, or at least have a meeting with a specialist to see if that's necessary. You know, sometimes parents will call me and I'll kind of say, it might be worth just going through the school first to kind of see what comes up there, because it's a free resource to go through the school. And they usually do very comprehensive evaluations, much more comprehensive than you would get through a pediatrician who's just going to do a couple, you know, rating scales with teachers.
Does every student with ADHD, do they receive a 504, an IEP? Is there one or the other, both? What does that look like for parents?
So they don't necessarily receive anything. That's not like a given. In the OCR letter that Lori was talking about earlier, it does state that at a minimum, kids with ADHD should be on a 504. And I don't know, with your listeners that are on the podcast, do you think that they're highly familiar with 504 versus IEP? Or should we be kind of like delineating what those are?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay, perfect. So when we're looking at a 504 plan, 504 plans are going to provide accommodations. And so these are kind of different. We're going to, I think, get into accommodations in a little bit here, but these are different ways that we can support kids in the classroom, how they access the curriculum, how they show what they know. So things like preferential seating, maybe letting them listen to an audiobook instead of reading. And you can do accommodations for all different areas, not just ADHD. So a child who's having difficulty with reading might need accommodations, but they would also most likely need intervention. And those interventions are going to be on an IEP. That's an individualized plan that's designed for each child individually. And that's kind of like, in some ways, a higher level of support. So you wouldn't have an IEP and a 504. If you just need accommodations, those are going to be on your 504 plan. If you're getting intervention and accommodations, those would be on an IEP. What else would you ladies add to that?
Lori, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think the IEP is really for kids who need specialized instruction, where you're kind of saying, we need a specialist to work with this child, my child, to develop these skills in a specific area, whether that's a special education teacher, a speech language pathologist, or a psychologist, where we recognize that they need specific intervention to be successful at school versus just accommodating the typical curriculum to kind of level the playing field for them.
And that's well said. And I think it's great information for parents to have, because I think when you're talking about acronyms and IEP and 504 and what would provide my child with the most support, and having, again, thinking about bell to bell and thinking about not only learning barriers, but social, emotional, sensory, functional, and thinking about the whole child really comes into play. Which kind of leads us into switching that focus to what accommodations exist for students with ADHD in a school, and how can we be creative and not just use a drop-down menu, because every kiddo is different.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are so many accommodations. Just to kind of list a few that we kind of see for kids with ADHD, you know, many kids with ADHD, they have to be moving to regulate themselves. We see many kids not completing work, not completing homework, and having to, for instance, sit out at recess for either a period of time or the whole recess. So we talk with families all the time about how you might need to put that in a plan, that that's like not an option, because you're going to have more behavior problems in the classroom if they don't have that time to like move their body, which helps them regulate themselves in the classroom. Sometimes that's like giving them breaks throughout the day to just move their bodies. So it might be like scheduling breaks to like water the plants or take a note to the teacher or do various things in the classroom, so they're getting up to move their body in an appropriate way versus like getting up to like hit another kid or randomly walking around the classroom or doing things that maybe are disruptive, but giving them productive movement breaks. Sometimes it's, you know, chunking work, for instance. So kids with ADHD really have a hard time, you know, regulating their attention for long periods of time. They can't focus for as long as their peers. So it may be breaking tasks into smaller pieces and then giving them a reward kind of at the end of that, that they can work towards, that gives them essentially a break. So they might have a little sensory break, or they might get to do a drawing activity, or they might get to work on a project that's like exciting for them, or research something. So you can get really creative in kind of finding that child's interests and using those interests to kind of have like that immediate positive consequence to motivate them through those like non-preferred activities, you know, preferential seating. So if they're seated near a teacher who can kind of see when they're zoning out, I mean, it's hard with a classroom of 30 kids. And I'll even have kids in testing where like I'm giving them assessment to look at their attention to auditory information, and they'll just space out, and it's not noticeable at all. Like you wouldn't know that they were spacing out. The only reason I know is because they're not responding to the test, right? And I'm assessing that. But a teacher in a classroom of 30 kids, when they're teaching, it's hard to see them zoning out. So a teacher can kind of prompt them more often if they're seated in front, or even see that they're kind of getting off task. So those are just like a few examples. There are, you know, so many accommodations that exist for kids with ADHD.
And I think that the main takeaway is that our goal for a lot of the accommodations is going to be to, for kids with ADHD, is going to be to support their executive functioning. So kids with ADHD, when we talk about executive functions, I know it's kind of like an obscure term again, but it's really the idea of like being able to make a plan and stay organized. The executive functions help us stay on track. They help us with our working memory, which if you have like six different classes throughout the day, you need so much working memory, because you get home in the afternoon and you're like, I have no idea what happened at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I myself really struggle with this. I have post-it notes everywhere to like cue myself. And an accommodation for a child with ADHD might be writing everything down in their planner and checking in with a teacher to make sure that everything is written down in the planner. So really thinking of what are those executive functions and how can we support those? Because for kids with ADHD, a huge piece is things that are interesting to them. Their executive functions work a lot better when they're highly interested. So maybe if they're having to write a report, they can choose the book that they want to read or choose something that's of interest to them. But it really, when we're thinking about it, it's like going back to what are the main challenges? And a lot of times it's executive function related, but accommodations look really different for the child that's much more hyperactive versus like an inattentive child, like Lori was discussing. And so we try not to say like, these are, you know, the best accommodations for every kid with ADHD. And we try to do it more like, for a child who struggles with this, here are the accommodations that can be helpful. We actually have a free guide that's all about accommodations. And we talk about, like, for a child who's struggling, for example, to take in auditory information, just listening all day long is really challenging. Here's 5 accommodations that can be really helpful for a kid with that profile. Because parents, that's probably one of the most common questions. Like, parents, we get DMs every day. I have a 504 meeting today. Can you send me the accommodations that you recommend? And it's like a really double-edged sword, because we're excited that families are like, yes, I need accommodations. But at the same time, it's like really hard for us to say. And so we're more likely to say, here's 200 options, sort of categorized by needs. And then, you know, if you go to the table with all 200, the school's going to look at you like, yeah, that's not happening. But when we really focus in, like, okay, but what are the individual challenges that we're having? How can we support? And I think you said that, because you mentioned, like, how do we not have a drop-down menu? And I love that. Like, I know for goals, I supervised a lot of SLPs, and they're like, where's my goal bank? And I'm like, oh man, I will not be providing a goal bank. But we need to be really personalizing this to each child. And it starts with, like, okay, what is going well and what is not going well? What are their strengths and interests? And then how can we use those to really support?
Yeah. And if you're a parent and you just feel kind of lost in that process, there's a couple of ways of kind of working through that. You're not an expert on what accommodations are available for your child and might not be, and that's okay. You don't need to be going through an evaluation process or getting a comprehensive evaluation. Typically that person is going to provide a list of accommodations that are tailored, you know, to your child or what might be helpful for them. So that's one way of kind of getting advice on that. 2 is sitting down with the team. And here's where your input is so essential, because you as a parent know what your child is coming home and complaining about or saying this is hard for them. Whereas, you know, they're not necessarily telling their teacher those things. So you can come into the meeting and say, you know, for instance, I had a child who was, you know, older elementary, who was sitting in the back of the classroom by a mirror, and all the girls in the classroom were coming back there all day long, checking their makeup and their hair. And he was coming home and saying, "Mom, I am so distracted all day. These girls are in the mirror, like, checking themselves out, and they come back there like 20 times a day, right?" But he's not told the teacher that, right? So you as a parent can come to the meeting and tell them, hey, he's saying these things. Can we seat him over here away from the mirror so that he can focus better? So again, you as a parent can come and say, these are the challenges that my child is saying, like, this is hard. So let's problem solve. You know what accommodations are available. I don't. But let's, as a team, kind of problem solve and put our heads together to be creative about how do we solve this problem. And that's where the team school process can be really helpful. I think another thing parents need to know is teachers and a lot of school professionals don't understand ADHD. They just don't know what that is. They don't know what it looks like. I go to meetings all the time where they will say, I don't think this child has ADHD, but then the teacher will be like, he never starts his work. Like, and he's never completing, you know, I just see him not completing tasks in the classroom, or he just never remembers to, like, bring his homework home, or he brings it back to school and just never turns it in. Right.
But that's not ADHD. I love
right.
it.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure it's not ADHD, but, oh my goodness.
But again, I think most people in the school, and that's what parents need to know. I think a lot of times parents think, oh, these people are really educated about ADHD, and your teachers more than likely don't have any training in ADHD. They don't know what it looks like. They might have a preconceived notion that it's a kid who's really hyperactive, but they don't tie those things, those executive functioning challenges, to their ADHD and that being related to it.
There's so much goodness that you are saying, one about the training, and then the other one about executive function. And I always tell parents that, you know, you can open up the little notes app on your phone or Google Keep or whatever, and just start to mark kind of where you see the areas of impact for your child, like you said, at home, again, in those executive function areas, whether it's the breaking down long-term assignments, preparing for tests, note-taking, study skills, whatever, the initiation, task completion, any of those things, and then start to prioritize again, you know, what are the ones, the major impacts? Because kind of back to what you had said, Katie, if I show up to a meeting and I have a list of 200 things that are impacting my kid, that becomes overwhelming. So what are the top three, top five that are really you see as an impact? And then how can we, again, work as a team, like you have said, to support this student? And then for folks that are listening, if your teacher does not have the training and your child has an IEP, you can request for teacher training through an IEP to better educate your teacher, your child's teachers, plural, if they have more than one, if they're in middle school or high school, and to better, so they can better understand your child and how ADHD impacts your child. Because like anything, you know, ADHD looks very different for different students. And that goes along to the comorbidity and all of the things that go in to play. And so I think that education piece is really huge, so that the teachers then say, oh, okay, now I understand your kiddo, and now I know how to better support them.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And we have an online course that's all about supporting kids with ADHD in school. And one of the pieces of that is a handout that we created for parents to share with teachers. Because again, I think that's such an important point that Lori made, because we have a pretty large following on social media and we have a ton of teachers that follow us. And a lot of them are parents of kids with ADHD too. And so it's this kind of dual role that they're playing. And we talk to them all the time. And we did a poll recently, like, hey, if you're a teacher, a general education teacher, which most kids with ADHD are in the general education classes, what training did you get on ADHD in school? And every single teacher that responded, like hundreds, if not thousands of teachers, said zero. I had zero training in ADHD. And that's not an exaggeration. I'm Greek, so I love to exaggerate. But that is actually not an exaggeration. That is fact checked. And it's true. Like, I think that we all assume, like, oh, they're teachers. It's the same with the pediatrician. Like, of course, they're the professional. And I, as a parent, like, I'm not a professional. I don't know. But the reality is, a lot of teachers don't know a lot about ADHD other than what they've sought out themselves, either through continuing education or following bigger accounts that talk about these things. Like, it's just, they're really having to do a lot of work. But we know that a lot of kids in their classes have ADHD, and they're either flying under the radar, or the teacher is like already doing all this work to accommodate them. They just, it's not necessarily documented. One other thing I was going to mention, when you were talking about kids who struggle with things like note-taking and study skills, I wanted to just mention to any parents that are listening that if your child needs, that's kind of the line that we were talking about. So we have accommodations where we might give them an outline that they can fill in rather than having to take notes from scratch, right? And that's kind of an outline. But if your child needs direct intervention, like in specialized instruction to learn those study skills, to learn things like note-taking, to learn those things, those are going to be best served on an IEP. And schools are hesitant. I'm going to say it. They're hesitant to put kids with ADHD on an IEP. Oftentimes we start with the 504 and we say, let's start with accommodations. And that's okay. As a parent, like, we want to encourage you, you're part of your child's team and you can share your concerns, but it's always okay to say, yes, I think let's start there. And then let's set another meeting. You don't have to wait until an annual meeting. You might say, let's meet in 2 months and see where it's going. Because again, we can accommodate all day long. And I love accommodations. We think that's a great way to level the playing field, but that in and of itself is not skill building. It's not teaching new skills. And if your child needs that kind of instruction, that's going to be better served through an IEP, which again is kind of like next level. And you don't need to wait a whole year to decide if they're ready for that.
Do you have any advice for parents so that they can come in prepared for that meeting in terms of kind of more advocating towards an IEP and being having the data and the documents in place as a parent to be able to communicate that for the school?
Yeah, I think, you know, we always tell parents that it's a gray area. So if you go into it, and I go to IEP meetings all the time, and I know the law well, and I can argue either way, because I know the law. And if you know the law, you can really make a good argument. So I think that's where educating yourself about that and knowing, hey, this is a gray area. There's no right or wrong answer. And for most kids with ADHD, there's not really a right or wrong answer about an IEP versus a 504 plan. You can make an argument pretty well either way. So I think sometimes if you've tried a 504, and we'll recommend that sometimes to parents, is like, try just doing accommodations and see how they do, and schedule a meeting, you know, 3 months after you develop the 504 plan, you know, schedule it at your 504 meeting and say, I want to check back in and see if this is enough. Like, to see if my child is successful. And if not, it might mean that we need some more instruction in these executive functioning skills for them to be successful.
And in this case, Lori is not talking about kids who are struggling academically. So mm-hmm. if your child has like a reading disorder, math, those kinds of things, then yes, an IEP. So it's kind of like, we're speaking about the kids that would kind of be like, again, I put that in quotes, but like just ADHD, and where do they fall? That's really the gray area. So kids who need a lot of social support, kids who need specialized instruction in academics, they're going to fall to an IEP anyway. And ADHD might be a piece of that for them. That might be like a secondary eligibility under the other health impairment or something like that. But really it's the kids that we're thinking of right now is like, it's, they don't have specific learning challenges. It's really, yeah. Again, just executive functioning, which I mean, I don't know. So, I see it in my everyday life. I'm like, this impacts everything. This is not a just situation, but the schools view it often as, you know, if grades are okay, then they're doing fine. And that is not the case.
Yeah. So I think to give you an example, you go through an evaluation through the school and your child has ADHD symptoms, it's impacting them. But they're average academically, because this is a common situation, right? This school, if they're average academically, a lot of times the school is, we don't do an IEP. But in many of these situations, these kids are becoming aggressive. They're disrupting the classroom. They might be throwing chairs. They might be getting suspended frequently.
Refusing to go to school.
Refusing to go to school.
Refusal at home.
Where there's more like significant behavioral challenges. You can still get an IEP for behavior. And that's where a lot of parents don't understand that. But like, when your child's behaviors are significantly impacting their ability to thrive at school in kind of significant ways, you can get an IEP for that. Just because their academic skills are average does not prohibit them from getting specialized instruction for behavior or social skills or things like that. So that, I think that's important for families to understand. Or maybe your child doesn't have significant behaviors. Maybe you have a child with inattentive ADHD, but they've just transitioned to middle school. And now your child has 5 teachers and 5 classes to keep track of. And they are now, they used to be successful because they had lots of handholding. And now in middle school, there's this expectation that you write your stuff down and you keep track of it. And they're now getting C's, D's, F's, because they aren't bringing stuff home. They're not writing their homework down. They're not remembering to turn it in. They're average academically, but they're failing in school because of those executive functioning challenges. And so that's another one that we see a lot, especially with girls. I see that many times with girls who are really impacted with that executive functioning, but they're super sweet and they're people pleasers and their teachers love them and they accommodate for them, but they're really struggling. So that's like another example of, you could have a child who has average academic skills, but they're really struggling at school and, you know, sometimes failing because of those executive functioning challenges. And we would be looking at an IEP for a child like that.
And we've both sat in meetings, school meetings, where the school has looked at a child like that and said, it's a behavior problem. They're being oppositional, you know, and really interpret it through a lens of like laziness or almost like a character failure. And it's really important for parents who are listening, you know, if you don't have someone sitting next to you, like an advocate or the psychologist who did the private testing, that's another option sometimes. And that's why Lori's in a lot of those meetings. And I used to sit in those meetings too, is like knowing that you know your child the best. And so if you know that your child is not oppositional and that they're not lazy, they're really struggling in these areas, it's very important to speak up and give your input because you're an important part of the team. And I feel like every time we say that, people are like, really? I'm on my child's school team? Are you sure? I'm not a teacher. I am not credentialed. We're like, no, you are. You are on the team.
Yeah, you are.
You are very important. Yeah. And I think we as parents, like, I don't know. There's just something about it. We were just interviewing for our podcast. We were interviewing a school psychologist who has a daughter with ADHD. She herself is a school psychologist and she sits through hundreds of meetings every year. But she said, even when she walks into her daughter's IEP meeting, she immediately feels intimidated. And these are like her colleagues, but it's like a huge table and lots of people and they all have degrees. And so we want parents to know that, like, if you feel that your child's being mislabeled or misunderstood, you are their voice to say, no, that's not what's going on here. I think we need to dig a little bit deeper.
And to make that argument, schools love data. They love information like that. So bringing an outside evaluation that has data to support your child's challenges, keeping track of teacher emails. So sometimes a lot of kids aren't getting behavioral referrals. I talk to families all the time, but like, they have I had a family come in, mom sent me like 15 emails within a one semester period of like all these behavioral challenges that the teachers were going through that never made it to administration, right? So saving all those and bringing those to the table, like, look at all these emails and all these struggles we're having. Look at, the work samples of homework that I'm seeing at home. If I don't help my child, this is what they're producing independently. So like bringing any of the things that you're seeing and talking about how it's impacting them home or what you're seeing at home that they might not see at school is really important to kind of make that argument of this is really challenging. Or even the teacher saying, oh, I'm doing all these accommodations for your child during testing. So, many times teachers are letting kids retake tests because, again, they really want them to be successful. And that's so great, but it makes their grades inflated. It makes their grades look like they're really getting A's and B's. But if the teacher wasn't providing accommodations, they would probably be failing. So even if the teacher has told you in meetings, they're doing these things, come to the meeting and say, hey, they're getting okay grades right now because we're getting accommodations. Like mm-hmm. The teacher's doing accommodations in the classroom. That's the only reason why they're getting good grades. So all of that is good information to bring to a meeting when you're trying to make those arguments.
So I think I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, but have you seen an accommodation that where you're at the table, the team may have given you kind of some pushback, like either we don't do that, or I'm not sure how that's going to work. But then they said, yes, we'll go ahead and try it. And it's been like out of the park, the best thing.
I think in the past when I worked in the schools, personally, we used to do like a check-in, check-out program, which we talk a little bit in our course too, and provide that because it's an evidence-based school intervention for kids with ADHD. It requires effort. When there's a behavior plan in place, it requires effort on the part of the staff and the teacher to implement that. And you have to understand teachers have very little time. They have 30 kids. They have a lot going on. But I think many teachers might be hesitant to do that. But then once they do those interventions, they're spending so much less time managing these problems as they come up. Do you know what I'm saying? So like the teachers might be complaining that they're interrupting class all the time because they're blurting out, or I'm having to go over this work with them, or I'm having to handle these problems. Whereas if you get in front of them and provide a positive plan, yes, it takes some time, but now you're saving all this time in not having to manage the problem behaviors, right? So I have definitely seen that with teachers where they've been really hesitant, like, I don't want another behavior plan, where they were coming back to the table a month later and saying, wow, like we've seen like a lot of growth in this child's ability to like, now they have the skill of raising their hands. whereas they didn't a month ago, right? Where we've kind of systematically taught these skills, like we're talking about, and the teachers were kind of pleasantly surprised by how successful they were. And I've seen that many times.
Katie, do you have anything?
Yeah, I was just thinking along those same lines. I think it's really like getting ahead of the challenges. So I remember being in a meeting one time at a local school and talking about a child who was really having difficulty at recess. And so we were talking about like, maybe we could bring, we were brainstorming, you know, and how can we help support him, but also all the kids in the class were kind of coming in after recess. There was a lot of fighting and just things weren't going as well. And it was like, how could we get an aide or somebody to almost structure some activities at recess? I know recess can be such a fun time for the kids and we don't want kids to get their recess taken away, but it can also be a lot. We actually got a message from a mom yesterday who was saying, you know, my kid does so well in structure. And the minute the structure goes away, he goes to recess, he starts hitting his friends, like all these things start happening. And again, that same conversation around the table of, well, if we do this proactive strategy of planning like a parachute game or something like that, and then the kids can volunteer, they can participate if they want to. It's a lot of extra work. And I know that the school, you've got the admin who's like, this is a great idea. And then the school staff who's like, oh my gosh, who's going to do this? And when do I get to eat my lunch? But the more and more as we brainstormed, and it was a monthly check-in with this team, we realized like, wow, this is actually making a lot of impact. And not only on the child we were originally talking about, but the whole school, like that whole grade was doing a lot better by having those kind of strategies. So I think in a lot of the examples that come to my mind, it's really like the takeaway is there's a lot of investment of time either way. And we can spend a lot of time correcting behaviors, correcting kids with ADHD. They get so many more instructions, corrections, just a lot more feedback than their peers oftentimes. And this can lead to all sorts of things. But when we know that we're going to put in the time regardless, we can strategize that. And with the school too, strategize the time that's going to be put in on the front end. So something like putting in check-in, check-out, helping build a little more structure at recess for those kids who need it, and realize like, hey, at that point now, we're controlling the narrative a little bit more. And then the kids do benefit. And there's such a positive payout for that. For all of us. I know I don't like correcting my kids. I would much rather be, you know, proactive and figure out how can we set this up for success. And so I think that's kind of the general theme. And I think keeping in mind that for the most part, your child's educational team is there to support you. There are situations where you just can't always come to an agreement, but I think big picture, you're all in the same team and starting from that place can be really helpful.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Kind of as we wind down, and you kind of mentioned it, sometimes we don't come to an agreement, right? So kind of circling back to where we started and getting an assessment, what happens if a parent receives an assessment? And I know you guys have a class on this, you're going to share all that information, but I think it's good knowledge for parents to know and kind of have in the back of their mind and then come to you to get that information. But what if they receive an assessment and they're like, I don't agree with this. This does not look like my child. I don't agree.
Yeah. So I think I mentioned at the beginning that I specialize in doing independent educational evaluations through the school. And so basically, if a parent, the law provides this kind of thing for parents, that if they go through a school evaluation and you get to the end of that, and let's say, for instance, you really think your child has ADHD and needs an IEP, but they say, no, they're doing fine. We're not going to basically do anything. And you disagree with them. Or maybe they say your child has autism, but you don't think your child has autism and you feel like they have something else going on. So there's various reasons why you might come to the end of that. Sometimes it's, you know, I see my child struggling in math and they're every night we're working on this. And then the school came back and said, nope, they're average in math. They don't have any issues. Where you're kind of just not seeing that align with what you're seeing and you disagree with that, you can request through the school an independent educational evaluation, which is basically a third party coming in and doing an assessment that is free to you. So the school district pays for that evaluation. And this kind of third party, which is me or Katie sometimes, we kind of do our own assessment and give recommendations that then goes back to the school team. And the school team can use that evaluation to then make changes or update kind of what their needs are in the school setting. So we do those fairly frequently.
And as you mentioned, that's something that we get really in depth in our course, Shining at School. It's all about supporting kids with ADHD at school. But the four main areas that you can get an IEE would be, you can do a psychoeducational evaluation. That's what Lori does. A speech and language evaluation. That's my jam. You can do occupational therapy or what's called a functional behavior assessment. So for kids that are struggling behaviorally, and there's those four areas are the common areas where the school would assess, and then where you can request a second opinion or a third party evaluation.
Yeah. So many parents don't know that that's like a thing that's provided to them in the law. And it really is amazing because, like we were talking about earlier, it can be really hard to get a medical evaluation. Sometimes they're expensive. Sometimes it's hard to find providers. So if you go through the school and you're not finding that you agree with them, or maybe you don't even agree with like the supports that your child is getting and you don't know how to troubleshoot that, that's another reason that you might request that, IEE.
Whew, so much information packed in. So much. So I hope folks are listening, taking notes, sharing this podcast with others. As we are wrapping up, is there anything that I did not ask that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked?
I don't think so. I feel like we covered so much.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you had great questions. I think it's just such a journey. And I think each of the different areas that we covered, you know, probably someone different is like, oh yeah, that's where I'm at. Whether it's like all the way back at the evaluation or all the way at the end where you're just fed up and you need a second opinion. It's a journey and we're all kind of on this journey together. And so hopefully there's something in there for each person, but no, I think that you covered everything.
If you had a billboard that you could put one tip for parents, what would it be and why? Final question.
Ooh, I like it. Lori, do you want to go or do you want me to go?
You are your child's advocate and you have to kind of throughout their schooling, understand that and really embrace that and know you have your child's best interest in mind, you and you alone. And so you have to go into those meetings, understanding that and really advocating for them. It's just essential throughout their whole schooling.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you can fit that on a billboard, but.
No, I think the first part, you are your child's best advocate.
Okay.
There you go. How can folks get in touch with the Childhood Collective?
Perfect. So you can definitely find us on Instagram at the Childhood Collective. We are on there pretty much every day. We share lots of funny stories and relatable parenting tips, but also a lot of tools to support kids with ADHD at home and school. We also have a website, thechildhoodcollective.com, which has an extensive blog. We recently launched our podcast, Shining with ADHD. Yep, we're pretty excited about it. Need to get you on there. That's going to be top of the list. But so you can find that wherever you podcast, and it's also available on our website if that's just an easier way to locate us. But we do have two online courses. They're self-paced, so parents can take them on their own time without a babysitter in your pajamas. And one of those is called Creating Calm. That's all home-based strategies, a lot of executive functioning, emotion regulation, supporting behaviors and building connection, just kind of helping support building routines, all kinds of things that are tried and true and research-based to help families with ADHD at home. And then we have our course, which we've talked about a little bit more today, Shining at School. That is all the tools you need for going into these meetings, feeling prepared. We have workbooks with each of our courses. So there's a lot of handouts and things for people to get really tactical and kind of practice and that kind of thing. So we also have, if you were wondering more about accommodations, we do have a free guide to ADHD accommodations. And as I mentioned, it's divided up based on the challenges that your child has at school. That can be a great place to start. It's just a free guide. You just put in your email address and you can download it. And that'll get you a great start if you're about to walk into a 504 meeting and going, I don't know what to ask for.
Fantastic. This was so good. I appreciate your time and talking through all this. And I know this is going to resonate with a lot of folks that are listening. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and BrainCamp, our executive function support model. If you are a parent, I've got you covered. Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and I can walk you through that IEP journey.